Here's where you can find out more about protecting seniors with dementia from financial abuse. Welcome to our Brain Science and the Law podcast for April 2010 on dementia and financial abuse of the elderly. This is Dr. Valerie Stone from Answers About Competency, LLC. So in today's podcast, I'd like to focus on five key points. First, scammers and thieves target the elderly for two reasons. They have more resources, and they assume that older people are more likely to fall for deception. Second, the stereotype that older people are more frail and vulnerable is not true in healthy aging. Third, only a minority of seniors, those who have dementia with significant mental deficits, are more vulnerable to being taken advantage of, but that minority are really vulnerable. Fourth, having a diagnosis of dementia by itself does not mean that someone has lost their decision-making capacity. It depends on how advanced the deficits are. Fifth, in thinking about setting up legal arrangements for seniors, whether it's a change in a will, a trust, or setting up power of attorney or guardianship, consider the social context your clients are in and whether those around them, even children, could easily take advantage of them. Have you ever wondered who falls for those email scams? I'm a Nigerian prince. Help me get my money out of Nigeria. I just need your bank account information. Well, the answer may be it's people with dementia who fall for those. Dementia is a gradual cognitive decline caused by underlying damage to the brain. Alzheimer's is the most common type of dementia. There are other kinds. People understand that someone with a physical disability, a blind person or someone in a wheelchair, might be targeted for robbery. But as a society, we haven't fully realized how people with brain disorders might also be at high risk of victimization. Let me start with an example of a very sad case in which a senior lost his life savings and his children lost their inheritance. Lewis, 60 years old, lived on his own after his wife died. He was fine driving and doing his shopping, making his own meals. His children knew that he had some problems. He needed some help with keeping track of his bank account, balancing his checkbook, and doing his taxes. His doctor said that Lewis had a more rare form of dementia called frontotemporal dementia. It starts at a younger age than Alzheimer's, but that his memory would be fine for a few years. Memory is preserved a bit longer in frontotemporal dementia than in Alzheimer's. So his kids were worried, but they didn't want to get involved yet in setting up power of attorney arrangements or taking over managing their dad's finances. They just came to see him regularly and helped him with the things that he had trouble with, like his taxes. Lewis had a computer and thought email was a great thing. So one day he got an email from a man in Africa who needed help getting his millions out of his country, but needed a foreigner's bank account to do it. All of us know this one. But did Lewis recognize this as the common Nigerian email scam? He did not. Did he stop to wonder if email to strangers was how legitimate financial arrangements were made? No. Did he ask his kids about this possibility to see if they thought that this seemed like a legitimate offer? He did not. Did he check the AARP website on common email scams to see if this was listed there? No, he didn't. Did he write to the African man and ask for some verification? No, he just took the email message at face value, sent off the details for his retirement savings account, and was shocked and horrified when the hundreds of thousands of dollars in there disappeared overnight. He had no more savings to support him in his retirement and no inheritance left to give his children, and because it went to a foreign place, he had no way of recovering the money. He was also terribly embarrassed and ashamed that this had happened. Afterwards, he could see what he should have done, but in the moment, he had acted impulsively. The reason he acted impulsively was because his dementia affected exactly those parts of the brain that allow us to inhibit our impulses and to consider decisions more carefully, the frontal lobes of the brain. Obviously, after this, his children worked to set up a financial power of attorney so that they could handle his finances and protect him. But they hadn't realized until this happened how much the dementia had affected their father's ability to make decisions. Now, Lewis fell for a scam that's put out widely by email, but there are a lot of scam artists who target the elderly specifically. Perpetrators of financial fraud target seniors for two reasons. First, older people generally have more money to steal than younger people do. And second, scammers, like a lot of people in our culture, assume that seniors are more likely to be confused and to fall for deception. Now, this stereotype is not actually true, which I'll get to later, but it does mean a huge variety of scams are targeted at seniors. Financial abuse and fraud committed against older adults are fairly common, happening 13 times more often than robbery by burglary or mugging. Financial exploitation can be perpetrated by many different kinds of people: strangers, healthcare workers, and sadly, even sometimes financial professionals and lawyers, or people posing as such. I've written a chapter in a book for judges about the wide variety of scams that are out there and how seniors can fall prey to them. You can email me at vestone@assesscompetency.com if you'd like a copy of that. But it's not just strangers who commit fraud and abuse. Financial abuse can also be carried out by neighbors or acquaintances from groups such as churches, and even family members. In fact, in 55% of elder financial abuse cases, the ones committing fraud are the senior's family, friends, or neighbors. Like scam artists, they do so because they assume that they can, because they assume that seniors are more frail or vulnerable. Now, many people in our culture hold this stereotype of seniors as fragile, vulnerable, and easy to take advantage of. So is that true? Well, our research shows that the stereotype is false for healthy elderly people. In fact, we found that the older one is, the less likely one is to fall for a scam. Older people are more experienced and wiser. They know a lot of the scams out there. They have a better sense of how the world works and what a legitimate financial deal is. Wisdom is real, and it's one thing seniors have that helps protect them from financial abuse. The only seniors who are more vulnerable to deception are those who have dementia that is advanced beyond the early stages, causing some significant mental impairment. And it's not just memory problems that make someone vulnerable. Remember, Lewis's memory was still fine. Dementia can make social judgment worse, too. So in assessing whether someone's vulnerable, you don't just need to know whether someone remembers how to write a check. They might be able to do that just fine. You also need to know whether they show good judgment about who they write checks to. I worked with Dr. Stephen Greenspan of CU's Department of Psychiatry and Dr. Donna Pinsker of the University of Queensland to develop a questionnaire that gets at social judgment to assess whether someone is vulnerable to scams and deception, called the Social Vulnerability Scale. And we used this to study 266 older adults, 116 of whom had dementia and 150 of whom were healthy. We also gave them several other psychological tests. We found a huge difference in how likely these groups were to be vulnerable to exploitation. The group with dementia was about twice as likely to be vulnerable in this way. The presence of dementia was the best predictor of who was vulnerable to exploitation and who was not. Furthermore, we found that cognitive abilities, like memory and problem solving, explained less than half of this effect. So it's not just cognition that needs to be evaluated in a capacity assessment. In fact, we found that social skills and self-awareness were more important in predicting who was vulnerable and who was not. So obviously, we concluded that considering someone's social judgment is a really crucial part of understanding their decision-making capacity. We believe, but we don't have evidence for this in research yet, that starting to fall for scams or exploitive schemes, any pattern of change where suddenly the person seems to be showing consistent poor judgment where they did not before, might be a warning sign of dementia. In any case, if you're dealing with a situation in your practice in which financial abuse is possible, it is absolutely key to know whether that person has dementia or not. However, it is very important to remember that a diagnosis of dementia by itself does not mean that someone cannot make sound decisions. Dementia is a progressive disease, and in the early stages, many aspects of mental capacity are still fine. It's only as the disease advances that someone may have trouble making good decisions. So for that reason, in many jurisdictions, a diagnosis of dementia is not considered sufficient to rule a person incompetent, nor is a diagnosis of any kind. Instead, some impairment in decision-making capacity in relevant domains, like financial decisions or healthcare decisions, needs to be demonstrated beyond just the diagnosis. Generally, courts rely on psychologists, neurologists, psychiatrists, or doctors to provide evidence about decision-making capacity. And they can't just say, well, he's got Alzheimer's and he scored poorly on this memory test. They have to give more specific information about decision-making, such as, well, he scored poorly on this memory test, and when he was given a list of costs and benefits of certain medication, he could not repeat them back to me. Therefore, I believe his capacity to make decisions about his own health care and medications is in question. Researchers like myself, Jennifer Moy at Harvard, Michelle Carson and Jason Brandt at Johns Hopkins, and Daniel Marson at the University of Alabama are working on developing tools for psychologists to use in evaluating someone's ability to make decisions in real-world situations. We've focused on that aspect of financial decision-making that is vulnerability to exploitation. Dr. Marson has developed specific tests of the ability to interpret financial documents like account statements or the ability to understand a complex health insurance document. The Johns Hopkins team has come up with a pillbox test to assess whether someone can keep track of their own medications. Jennifer Moy has written a lot about how clinicians can test for specific kinds of decision making by asking the person to do specific relevant tasks like balancing a checkbook, or explaining the costs and benefits of different health treatment options. More and more often, courts are asking for this kind of domain-specific evaluation of people's decision-making abilities because a diagnosis is not enough. Now, sadly, there are still some jurisdictions where that is enough and where judges might just consider, well, they've got dementia and they fell down a couple of times as enough reason to rule someone to be incompetent. I know of cases where that's happened. Fortunately, in most jurisdictions, that's not the case. And a diagnosis is not enough because some dementias progress slowly, and the person may be fine to make their own decisions for years. Independence should be guarded for as long as possible. So even in seniors who have dementia, their ability to make competent decisions depends on their particular abilities, and that varies from one person to another. I used the example of Lewis earlier, who fell for a scam perpetrated by a stranger. Now, if his children had gotten involved sooner in helping him manage his finances, they could have protected him. But they were good kids who wanted to help their father and protect his best interests. Not all family members have the senior's best interests at heart. Family members, often children, have been known to put their own desire for their elderly relative's money ahead of the elderly person's own interests. So it's very important for attorneys and judges to consider whether a senior might be put in a position where they could be exploited financially. For example, some adult children or recent younger spouses persuade an elderly parent or spouse or other relative to give them financial power of attorney or to let them co-sign on a bank account. Then they transfer money to their own private bank accounts and use the senior's money to buy things for themselves. They might transfer real estate titles to their own names or rewrite a will to exclude other family members. Friends and neighbors, attorneys, or people posing as attorneys or court-appointed representatives can do the same. If someone is trying to get an older person to set up a power of attorney or is petitioning for guardianship, they may be trying to get someone declared incompetent who is not. So in addition to doing a very careful evaluation of the person's decision-making capacity, I would encourage courts to consider social context in these cases as well. How much do they stand to gain? Will they gain substantially by being in control of the senior's finances? Will the person acting as financial representative act in the senior's best interests? How will their decisions be monitored? Is there any evidence thus far that they've tried to take advantage of the senior's financial resources? And because such situations are not uncommon, and because someone with dementia may have compromised judgment and not realize that a family member could take advantage of them, I want to emphasize again that when the courts consider a senior's decision-making capacity, some kind of information about the person's social judgment should be part of that evaluation. You don't just need to know whether someone has dementia or just whether they have cognitive problems. You need to know how those issues affect everyday decision-making in social situations. Information about social judgment could come from a formal quantitative assessment by a psychologist, or if that's not available, from qualitative interviews with the elderly person and those close to them. Now, given the prevalence of financial abuse perpetrated by family members, it would be desirable to get information from multiple sources if possible, not just family members. Furthermore, it might be important to examine warning signs, such as recent transfers of large sums of money from a senior's account, or recent changes in a will or trust, and to consider the social circumstances surrounding any such transfers or changes. Did the person know and understand what was being done? Did they consent to them? Can they describe the change or transfer and their reasoning for making the decision? Any of these might indicate a senior's social vulnerability, vulnerability to exploitation, and might indicate that the senior has some difficulty in weighing information relevant to financial decisions. On the other hand, depending on the answers, it might show that everything's fine and the person made good decisions, that they understood. It will, in practice, be very difficult to use rigid guidelines to determine whether a senior has been taken advantage of in these situations. But asking questions and asking about the person's social judgment and social context may help in making a wise determination. Formal assessments that include social judgment, social skill, and cognitive functioning will provide valuable evidence in cases involving competency. In many parts of the U.S., prosecutors can ask for enhanced criminal penalties for criminals who commit abuse against people who are members of a vulnerable group, or for someone who's in a position of trust and abuses that position, such as a caregiver or guardian. People with dementia are clearly a vulnerable group. With so many different methods used to commit financial abuse against seniors, it's important to identify factors affecting vulnerability to such abuse. Age per se is not one of those factors. Older people are not more likely to be deceived. In fact, they're less likely, as long as their brains are healthy. Even in early stage dementia, someone's ability to make decisions may still be fine. But as it progresses, dementia can make people more likely to fall for scams and deception. This is not just because of problems with memory and cognition, but also because of problems in social judgment. If you think about it, social interactions are some of the most complex situations we deal with day to day. So it does make sense that compromised brain function would show up in problems with social judgment. So I would just conclude by asking attorneys and judges to consider all these factors: the presence of dementia, cognitive abilities, social judgment, and ability to do specific tasks relevant to specific decisions, as well as the social context that the person is in, whether they might be vulnerable to those who are going to be in a position to make decisions for them, when a question comes up about someone's competency to make decisions. We can balance protecting the vulnerable with protecting independence. Thanks for listening to this Brain Science and the Law podcast. I've talked about some of my research and others' research in this podcast. My articles are available on my website, www.assesscompetency.com/articles.html. Information in this podcast is up to date as of April 2010. For more information about dementia and CLE workshops that we offer on those topics, go to our website, assesscompetency.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next month, where we'll talk about the differences between two types of traumatic brain injury, mild TBI and complicated mild TBI, and how those might affect cognition and decision making.